I am not a Black woman in the world. That is not my narrative. I don't share the same narrative as my African-American sister, who is aesthetically and visibly darker than I am. We don't have the same narrative. Our Blackness is not the same, but I am Black.
From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today, a conversation about Afro-Latinidad and who gets to claim it. As you think about February, which is Black History Month, have you thought about this, the contributions and experiences of Latinos and Latinas of African descent? These are people who have and are currently navigating what it means to be both Black and Latino in the United States. Latinos like Arturo Schomburg, the Puerto Rican-born Black historian whose research resulted in, some say, one of the largest collections of Black history in the world, which is at the Schomburg Center right here in Harlem, New York. So to mark Black History Month, we decided to revisit a conversation we first aired last year. We invited some friends of Latino USA to talk about their experiences as being Afro-Latinos in the U.S. In this conversation, we asked some fundamental questions. What is Afro-Latinidad? And who gets to claim it? And joining me in Harlem, Amilcar Priestley, who's co-director of the Afro-Latino Festival here in New York City and director of the Afro-Latino Project, Marjua Estevez, who's associate editor at Billboard, M. Tony Peralta, who's a contemporary artist and owner of the Peralta Project, and Jamila Brown, who's owner of Hue, which is a digital marketing company. And I want to thank all of you for joining me on Latino USA. And I don't know, let's just jump right in. So when was the first time that each one of you were like, oh my God, I am Afro-Latino, I have African roots? And what was that like?
For me, I spent, the better part of my adolescent years in Florida, in the South. I was anything but Dominican over there. And, you know, everywhere I went, I was a mixed person. It was like, oh, you're Black and white. Oh, you're this. They had a bunch of nicknames for me except what I was, you know, and that was conflicting. I had huge identity issues coming up. But when I walked out into the world, people perceived me in many different ways. And at 19, going on 20, was the first time that there was a book available that I picked up and learned about my Dominican history. Mm. It's a shame that it took me 20 years to have access to something like that. If I was an African-American woman, I'd be sort of, you know, confused too. Yeah. If she saw me walk in the room talking about some, I'm Black.
Yeah.
You know, like I'd be confused too, if because it's not being taught.
Right.
It's not being taught.
Right. It is not the most present statistic to say at one point there were more Africans in Latin America than in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
So, Tony, what was your...
I mean, I remember vividly, you know, I was probably 17 years old
in New York City
in Washington Heights. And my friend was like, you know, we Black, right? I was like, what? Yo, we Dominican. What are you talking about? It's like, no, yeah, we're Dominican, but like, you know, slaves went to the American Republic and, you know, we're Black. He just blew my mind. And there was a little bit of pushback.
Of course.
But I was like, I was just so confused. So, yeah, like the first book that I picked up was Malcolm X on African-American history. And I read that and it changed my life because it started to talk about, you know, the slave trade and like slaves being dropped off in the American Republic and stuff like that. And that I was just so fascinated by that.
But I mean, I'm fascinated. I'm interested in the pushback. Like when he said, yo, Tony, we're Black and you pushed back. What was
it? Yeah, because, you know, growing up, being el morenito de la familia wasn't seen as like you're not desirable. You know what I'm saying? Like that's how I grew up. I grew up with low self-esteem and my low self-esteem came from our language.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? You know, my mother telling me, yo no sé dónde tú saliste con el pelo tan malo.
Your mom said that to you?
Yeah, of course.
Like, my mom said that to me.
Of course. That's like, that's part of
like when she's combing your hair, she's like, yeah. Ay, ¿por qué saliste con este pelo malo? Which basically means, why did you come out with all of this bad hair?
Yeah, no, who? Where, from where you came out with this bad hair? ¿De dónde saliste con este pelo tan malo?
which person?
Yeah, in which our part lineage? Of my lineage? And mine was hers, right?
And that's the messed up part about it.
You know, or you know, it's like me being the darkest one. First of all, it was the darkest one for my family, and then it was the darkest one for my set of friends, and they were always seen as the cute ones.
Okay, Amilcar, and what about you? Because you know, your dad, George Priestley, was like an icon in New York and internationally for bringing the conversation of Afro-Latinidad front and center in academia. So what was your experience like?
I was wearing a Malcolm X hat when I was 12. Mm. I've always been pretty militant. You ask some high school friends of mine, I mean, I've kind of always been this way. But again, like, my dad was involved in this. Like, I mean, my upper, I was sitting around, people were, you know, I mean, I wouldn't say plotting revolution, but they were involved in deep conversations about how to deal with these things.
There was some plotting going on. I know all these people. There was some plotting.
There's always plotting.
There's a little plotting going on. So, Jamila, what about for you?
Honestly, the black came first and then the Latinidad came mm-hmm. afterwards. So there really are two points. So I remember, I think I was about 10. So I was in Panama and I was with my favorite Titi Sonia. And I remember telling her, I was like, you know, I don't really like the word negra because it kind of reminds me of the N-word. And she looked at me and she said, mira, pero yo soy negra. Mm-hmm. Yo soy muy orgullosa para ser negra. And she's like, no, like, I don't like morena. It washes down my blackness. Black is who I am. So I was like, I'm 10, but okay, cool. And then a couple months later, I was going into sixth grade. And we had a presentation by one of our student teachers who had lived in Panama in the 70s. And she said the most awful things about the country. Like that really stereotypical, you know, third world, like desolate place, as opposed to, you know, the beautiful, vibrant, colorful country that I knew and loved. At the end of her presentation, we had a vote as to who wanted to live in the United States and who would want to live in Panama. And I raised my hand for Panama. And that was like a moment where I was like the world is like forcing me to choose. So I was trying to figure out for myself. I was like, well, I have to figure out a way to be both.
So who gets to claim being Afro-Latino in this moment? Who gets to actually rightfully own it?
Go ahead. I think anybody who has that lineage of, you know, the places that the ships stopped, the slave ships. It's whoever has African blood in them.
So you're basically like anybody who has any percentage of African blood who wants to own Afro-Latinidad can and should?
Well, I mean, if you have 1%, you know,
well,
what's
the percentage then?
Me personally, I think is what do you see visually? You know what I'm saying? So it's not skin tone per se, because there's people que son jabao that are super light skinned that have white.
Okay, you can't just drop that word.
A jabao is a word that we say in the Dominican Republic that is somebody who's very light skinned but has black features. They have thick nose. To me, where it's visible, it's mm-hmm. somebody that can claim that, because when it's visible, that's when you're kind of discriminated against.
Absolutely. I think that aesthetics play a huge role in how you move in the world, how you are allowed to move in the world, and how people digest you and how they receive you. You know, colorism is real. You can't be a Becky and call yourself Afro-Latina or Afro-whatever.
You can't be
a Becky. Right? Like, it's just, let's be Becky. Real. Let's be real. In no
Is that room, also what they call them in the Dominican Republic?
Una Becky? No. Maybe, right? Una Becky. I am not a black woman in the world. That is not my narrative. I don't share the same narrative as my African-American sister, who is aesthetically and visibly darker than I am. We don't have the same narrative. Our blackness is not the same, but I am black.
Yeah, for me, it's really about, did you live a black experience? Mm. And that is the biggest thing for me, because for me as a dark-skinned Latina, mm-hmm. it's been a very interesting life to walk through, because people first, they assume so many different things, you know, and it depends on where I am. It depends on where I am in Latin America. It depends mm-hmm. on where I am in the United States. You know, I grew up in St. Louis and I always talked about passing for African-American, and that becomes troublesome for some people. It definitely makes Latinos very uncomfortable, because anti-black racism is extremely real in our community. Yeah. It makes African-Americans uncomfortable, because you know, when I started speaking Spanish in my Spanish class in high school, you know, it was a problem. Like, all of a sudden, I didn't have any friends. Wow. You know, the black girls stopped talking to me. But what's the most important is that we, as Afro-Latinos, we do have black experiences in our home countries. And we do face the same kind of barriers and discrimination. And it's really about that. It's about, you know, culturally, where do you come from? Like, what do you hold dear? What is closest to you? You know, I'm really happy to be in this room because we're all like different shades and it reminds me of my family. I call my family the black rainbow, you know,
Ooh, I like that. We need more of that.
Yeah, we need more of that.
So here's the interesting thing. The question comes up to my daughter. I married a man from the Dominican Republic who is Afro-Taino. So she does not necessarily present, but she's clearly mixed, but not clearly Afro. And she started to ask the question because she wants to understand deeply and have a political consciousness as a POC woman. But I think she also is like, but I also don't want to take ownership of something that I can't. Coming up on Latino USA, we pick up the conversation with this. Does someone like my daughter, Jurema, does she have a right to claim Afro-Latinidad? And if so, what does that mean? Stay with us. No te vayas.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Now, when we left off, I had just asked our experts and friends of Latino USA, Marjorie Estevez, M. Tony Peralta, Amilcar Priestley, and Jamila Brown. And this was the question that I asked them. Does my daughter, who is half Dominican and whose dad is Afro-Taino, have the right to claim being Afro-Latina? So what do you think?
I mean, I think in that situation, you know, she does have, you know, if her father being Afro-Taino or whatever, like, if she wants to claim that, she has all the right to.
I mean, and she, you know, do the work.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Do
exactly.
The work.
Exactly.
Do the work.
Yeah.
I mean, know your history.
When you say do the work, what does that mean?
Know your history. Go dig into it. Read, you know,
be prepared.
Be prepared to find out things that you might not want to know.
Right. One way that I've been thinking about race a lot lately is, like, what color does a police officer say you are?
That's right.
So there's that, like how people perceive you and how you walk in the world. And then there's the social and cultural where, you know, by all means, that's her father's history, that's her family, you know, lineage and heritage. Learn it. Even for me, like being the descendant of Caribbeans who came to build the canal in Panama, I had to learn about my Caribbean history. So in order for me to really embrace the fullness of who I am, I took the time to understand where they came from and what that history was and what that meant for them to come to Panama.
Yeah. This is what I call an evergreen conversation, right? And so there's always going to be a generation of folks who are discovering their identity within the context of Afro-Latinidad. This isn't, but by no means, and I definitely want to be clear on this, is not a new conversation. As you said, like you were involved in this conversation. My father was involved in this conversation 40, 50 years ago in Peru. Nicomida Santa Cruz is from the 60s. You had the first black organizations in Cuba in the 1920s, 1910. Like, we're not new to this at all.
So there's a story that my dad told. He takes the bus from Tampico to Chicago for the first time. And so when the bus crosses into Texas, this is in the early 1950s, and they get off to go to the washroom, my dad has to make a decision. Is he white? And he's like, pues soy un poco negro, but I'm also not white. And it makes me think about the negotiations that you guys have to do on
constantly.
A daily. And I'm just like, I can't even begin to imagine
the dichotomy for me is interesting because in some rooms I'm never Latina enough. In other rooms I'm never Black enough. I'm constantly code switching. Even within my own family, just having to deal with the anti-Blackness in that sphere.
Which is looks very, like what?
Which looks like, you know, all of my Black aunts denying anything remotely.
Yo no soy negra.
You know, and it's talking about hair. It's like, go get your hair done. Or don't stay in the sun for too long. Or, you know, there's this language that we've built.
Those are the kind things, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
What are the ugly things that you hear and have heard?
I was called a mono by a family member.
Wait, someone in your own family called you a monkey? What did you do?
Yeah, I was a teen and she was angry and she called me, you know, maldito mono.
It's ingrained and it comes from a very historical, particularly in the Dominican Republic, that Trujillo era played a huge role. I mean, anti-Blackness existed way before him, but Trujillo definitely ushered in an entire new wave of that. And it affected my family. Yeah. You know?
Well, you know, I mean, I was recently looking at some photographs. And you saw in front of you the fact that he did whiteface.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he powdered himself.
Like, he was doing whiteface all the time.
He slaughtered generations of Haitians and Black Dominicans. And those are traumas that you have to face at the end of the day.
There is this racism, this anti-Blackness that exists throughout Latin America and the United States. I mean, in a lot of ways, we've been through this for years now. Like, in the case of Philando Castile, who was shot and killed by Geronimo Yanes, who was Mexican-American. And this notion of, like, you bought in to the entire narrative of anti-Blackness as a Latino, and you acted on it.
Yeah, I mean, I would even take it maybe a step further and say, like, is it that they bought into anything new, or is this something that has always existed? So you're here. How are you treating your people back home? Are you clutching your purse? Are you talking about somebody's hair? Are you telling somebody that you don't want to live in a certain neighborhood? Mm. That's a question that needs to be asked. And I like to ask that question, and I like to watch the reaction that people have.
So if there are non-Latinos who want to be better allies, what to do?
One of the things that really frustrates me is that every Hispanic Heritage Month, it's the same recycled story about the Afro-Latino who's discovered their Blackness and come into it. And I'm like, that is not all of our stories. Mm-hmm. Like, I have met very proud Black Peruvians, Black people from Honduras, Cuba. I mean, my goodness. Cuba is Africa. And, you know, we need to show the diversity of that, because white people have an instrumental role in dismantling white supremacy. Yeah. So they need to educate and challenge themselves.
And then also, you know, just people need to show the spectrum of Latinos, not only Afro-Latinos, but we have Asians and definitely mm-hmm. indigenous folks. Like, you know, show the beautiful rainbow indigenous that what it is to be Latin American.
We have the framework for an Afro-Latino movement in the United States. I don't necessarily think there is one yet, but we have to get to that point. There has to be somewhere along the lines, a platform. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we've quite reached that point yet.
Yeah, not yet.
For folks here who are doing this work, you can't be serious about doing this work if you're not looking at the people back home doing this work. Now, there are differences living in the United States, but they have created a framework. And so you can't be ahistorical about it, and you can't negate the work that people have already put forth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I have really worked with, particularly in the U.S., is talking about confronting our own imperialism. Mm-hmm. And that really goes into it. You know, the fact that we just dismiss that this work has been going on in Latin America for centuries.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just the last 50 years. Yeah. Like, we have to start within ourselves, right? Like, mm-hmm. there's a lot blocking Afro-Latinos from uniting with African-Americans, you know, and Africans who are immigrants here because of those, like, divisions of imperialism. We have to unite around that. Mm-hmm. And then also, you know, Latinos right now, with all the racial profiling, I have to say, like, me da pena as Afro-Latina to see Latinos like, oh my gosh, we're being targeted by the police. And I'm like, so there are sections of Latinos who are Black who have always been targeted by the police. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you need us right now. Mm-hmm. You need us because you don't know how to navigate these spaces. We do. Because mm-hmm. even if we didn't know we were Black, when we stepped on the soil mm-hmm. in the United States, mm-hmm. the police officer told us, you know, and like a lot of the people who are being deported, large majorities of them are Black mm-hmm. people from Latin America. And we're not having that conversation mm-hmm. about how immigration is a racial issue. Mm-hmm. So we have to start confronting it from different levels because we all need each other, particularly in this political climate. You know, it's real right now.
And then what? Yeah.
What does that mean?
Because we can't be woke and broke. Right. Okay. We can't be woke and broke.
Exactly. Well, listen, you guys, thank you so much for joining us on Latino
thank
USA. This was great.
Thank you for having us.
It's been a pleasure.
Amilcar Priestley is co-director of the Afro-Latino Festival here in New York and the director of the Afro-Latino Project. Marjorie Esteves is an associate editor at Billboard. M. Tony Peralta is a contemporary artist and owner of the Peralta Project. And Jamila Brown is the owner of Hue, a digital marketing company. Thanks to everyone for such an honest conversation. Afro-Latinidad, Who Gets to Claim It, first aired in June of 2017. It was produced by Janice Yamoka and Jeannie Montalvo and edited by Nadia Raymond. The Latino USA team includes Marlon Bishop, Fernanda Chavarri, Andres Caballero, Antonia Cerejido, Sayer Quevedo, and Maggie Freeling. Our intern is Reese Williams. Our engineer and music editor is Cornelius McMoyler. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholtz. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next time, and in the meantime, find us on all of your social media. Ciao!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the California Endowment, building a strong state by improving the health of all Californians. The Winecode Foundation, supporting efforts that strengthen and enrich culture, community, and the natural environment. And the David and Lucille Packard Foundation, improving the lives of children, families, and communities, and restoring and protecting our planet.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, the story of one of the first Dreamer activists and her exhausting fight for citizenship.
I didn't want this black cloud over us, you know, for people to say, oh, well, he only married her for papers. Like, I feel like I've been proving my whole life that I'm not a fraud.
That's next time on Latino USA.
Thanks for listening to Latino USA. Help us out by telling us what you like and how we could improve by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcast survey. It takes just a few minutes and you'll do all of us at Latino USA a huge favor by filling it out. That's npr.org/podcast survey. Thanks.